That's great. And in concluding today's lecture, today's lecture session, we are happy to have Donna Futterman talking about youth and HIV. Are we on track to end the epidemic?
Thank you, Laura, and for all of you who are able to stay till the end of today or this part of today. It is a great privilege to be able to address an audience of practitioners in a meeting sponsored by HRSA. HRSA has long been out front and having our backs on providing the care to our underserved communities. And it's probably all of us know and respect them, but it's a relatively unsung part of a huge HIV and AIDS response. So thank you, Laura, and all your colleagues at HRSA. So are we on track to end this epidemic? I think, you know, all of us are very excited about the notion of ending the epidemic, but there are some really unique situations with teens that we need to address. I mean, one nice thing about adolescents is they continue to get older, and soon they're not adolescents. So Mike Sag just said to me, you've cured the epidemic in teens because they've all aged out. But not true, because there are new ones coming on board, and we're going to get to speak about all of that. So you're always supposed to check out your resources before you start, and I didn't do that. So I'm trying to figure out advancing the next slide. It's this big green one. Clever. Okay, with the arrow on it. Okay, it's just not in the place I'm used to. So I have received over the years service grants from Gilead, and there's a big issue right now in our community about how important it is to disclose any relationship you have with a drug or pharmaceutical company. So here it is. The total grant is now listed in my name as that I've received it. I haven't, but this is how we're now having to report these things. We hope that everyone will be able to look at which youth currently are most vulnerable to HIV, why they're vulnerable to HIV, and what are some of the challenges we face among youth. So youth and HIV is a big topic. I'm going to be doing highlights on many areas of both epidemiology, clinical care, and prevention. Adolescents living with HIV is a global issue. AIDS is the number one killer of adolescents 10 to 18 in Africa, number two worldwide. 2 million adolescents are living with HIV worldwide. Youth 15 to 24 are 37% of incident infections, about 380,000 a year. And in most of the world, new infections are among girls, 60% in fact, which is very different from the domestic U.S. epidemic. And every hour somewhere in the world, there are 26 new infections. So as we sit here through the course of this, there'll be 20 to 30 new infections. And you can see that HIV and AIDS concentrated in Africa along the East Coast and southern regions, very high numbers in India. We don't have data from a lot of the other countries. Eastern Europe is another place where HIV is pretty prevalent. But in the U.S., it also remains a very important issue. And one of the things you're going to see is the variety of ages on these slides, 13 to 19, WHO definition, 15 to 24, 13 to 29. We don't have an agreed-upon definition, so the numbers change by the age group that's discussed. But in the United States, there are still approximately 40,000 new cases a year, and about 16,000 of them take place among youth, which is represents 40% of new diagnoses, almost twice their rate of the population, which is about 23%. Females in the U.S. are 16% of adolescent cases, big contrast to the rest of the world, where it's 6-0. It takes an average of 2.7 years for most people from the time of infection to diagnosis. And things are changing all the time in HIV and AIDS, and we hear this, but it is important to note that now HIV is increasingly concentrated in the U.S. South, which has 52% of adolescent cases. In 2014, 90% of the diagnoses were in gay and bisexual males, and those who were 22 to 23 had the highest incidence of any age group. The other huge disproportion is racial and ethnic groups. Just over half of new infections still occur among black youth, where the new infections are 390 per 100,000, and also a disproportionately high rate of new infections in Hispanic and Latinos. 16% of the new infections are in white people. Now, there are numerous reasons for this, mostly historical racism and the structure of our healthcare institutions that perpetuate this. But also, and I think we should look around who we are in this room, much better representation of black and Hispanic clinicians, but who is still leading our movement? And that representation is not there. Who is still speaking for this? And that representation is not there. And this is hard to do, but it's something we have to do. We're hopefully in the last stages of this epidemic, and we need the wisdom, leadership, and different way of thinking about what we've done historically. And it's not easy, and, you know, I'm 66, on my way moving out, I hope someday. But we do have to really think about our sustainability and the next generation that's going to be taking over and working beside us. In the U.S. currently, there's about 1.2 million people living with HIV, and the data shows that still about 1 in 8 are not aware of their infection. The last time there was an excellent study of this, the number was 52% among youth, so four times the rate. Teenagers do not know they're vulnerable to this epidemic. They haven't been tested, and we still have work to do. Another way to look at this, the numbers I presented before, is that men who have sex with men are now accounting for 81%. Four out of five of new infections are among MSM or gay and bisexual youth. Of those, another almost 80% were young men of color, primarily in the South. This epidemic among youth is consistently hitting the most vulnerable young people in our society, gay, black, gay, Hispanic youth. And the South, as I mentioned before, has almost half of the new cases. I think, again, HRSA has been very smart in shifting some of its funding to account for this, but there are still cities and places like the Bronx, where I work, that remain epicenters. This is the CDC Continuum of Care in 2017, and you'll see on the far left are young people 13 to 24, and they consistently have the lowest rates of every step on the continuum. So from diagnosis to receiving care to retained in care to virally suppressed, they are about half to two-thirds of the other age groups. The next worst outcome age groups are young adults, 25 to 34. So clearly this is a population that needs more support, more funding, and more help. I'm going to stop for a second and ask you in the audience, how many of you like and feel comfortable taking care of teenagers? Raise your hands. So this is fantastic. It's one of the highest percentages I've seen in my talk. It's almost 50% from a just quick scan. It's a slightly biased sample in that you guys are willing to stay to the end of the lectures today. But taking that into account, it's not everybody. And we need to really know that among young people and their care providers, part of the problem is the care providers who are not comfortable, don't like, don't welcome, don't understand this population. And understanding this age group is not about knowing the latest musical groups, although that is a nice side benefit, that you get to know a lot more about common pop culture than you've thought about. But it's about giving that sense of respect and that sense of, I care for you, I'm taking you seriously as a person, I'm not dismissing you. And I'll talk a little more about that later. So just this, to me, could be the demographic slide that we want you to remember, which is adolescents do worse on every stage of the continuum. And I know it's giving Laura, I'll give you a word from the Bronx Spielkus, which is worry, intense worry even to heartburn, that this problem is persisting. So let's talk about the different parts of the care cascade and what some of the issues are. So optimizing the care cascade, HIV testing. I showed you that most youth don't know. It's anywhere from 30 to 50%, depending on where you are, the numbers tested. How could that be? Well, we need both routine and targeted testing. Routine testing is key in clinical sites. Unreleased data from the CDC is showing that half of the people who were diagnosed come from clinical care and the other half come from community settings. That means that we have to up our game in both of these settings. I work in New York where the laws are pretty restrictive still about HIV testing. You have to offer, document your offer, give 7 points that are mostly out of date. Why isn't HIV at this point a routine test like any other? There's no other test. We have to give out this level of information and obtain a written consent. There are so many disconnects in the hospital system that makes this impossible to do. You walk into our ED, an hour wait for triage. Adding what everyone says, oh, it's less than a minute to ask, is adding hundreds of minutes a day. It's not feasible. And what really is the harm of helping people find out if they're HIV positive? Or in New York, we have status neutral. Take the test, find out if you're at risk and need PrEP. Or take the test, you find out you're HIV positive, and you get into care. 98% of people are not going to be in either of those buckets. They're going to move on. So let's make our systems work for us. Outreach-based testing is also crucial. Many kids do not come into the hospital at any point. So what are the venues? What are the institutions? What are the places where we need to reach them? And I think this is another critical area. Testing has remained a backwater. I'm not really sure why. Maybe it's not as intellectually exciting as all as linkage to care. But in any case, it's a crucial issue and a crucial step in our work. So please, one of the things to go back, you know, in the old days, CDC funded testing and HRSA couldn't. Now there's a recognition of more integrated services. And if you're going to work with adolescents, figure out, think about this testing piece. Addressing consent and confidentiality with minors. Many places are moving towards minors being able to give their own consent, not only to testing, but also to care. And it's great if you have a parent involved, but not all parents can be involved, can be disclosed to. You'll hear the disclosure word repeated in every lecture that talks about the linkage to care for patients. And test all youth. At first, I didn't even get this. I thought, why are we testing virgins? You know, that didn't make any sense. Well, it turns out that not every teenager is going to tell a stranger or even their beloved provider the truth on first meeting. It doesn't happen. We have to accept and get that. Kids who have been abused might not think of that as sexual activity, might not disclose it, and it sets them up for a lifetime of difficulty around sexuality and disclosure. And then finally, those kids who are perinatally infected might not know it. We are in the middle of a case where a young man from Guatemala moved to this country, his parents have been giving him the meds, and now they say, help us disclose to him what these meds are for. So while we virtually eliminated perinatal transmission in the U.S., that's not true in the rest of the world, and there are still disclosure issues. So if we didn't test this boy who was never sexually active, we wouldn't have known, he wouldn't have known, and his future sex partners would not have known. So other recommendations, achieving routine testing, the most people who are going to do this testing are not the HIV world. They do one test a day, and they think they're testing everyone. That's not true, but ask people to monitor themselves, and they'll see that it's not happening as they feel it is. How do we expand our targeted testing, more frequent testing of MSM, and mostly trans women more than trans men? But I've started doing healthcare for trans folks over the last few years, and there are trans men, so they were born female and they've transitioned to male, who surprisingly to themselves, after they started taking testosterone, they were attracted to men. They're a man now and they're attracted to men. And it's not intuitively where you would think these guys would go, but we don't know why. So new immigrants are important, persons in neighborhoods with high seroprevalence. You could have sex once in the South Bronx and run into this virus. You could have sex 100 times in part of Iowa and never run into this virus. So we also need to look at geolocations, injection drug use, and not to just focus on the injection, any substance that lowers your inhibition. Migrant workers, homeless people, history of incarceration, substance use, and mental health issues, all are populations that are have higher vulnerability to HIV. We do need to have ways to think about and address acute infection because this is a time of high viral load in which these can be the most efficient transmitters of HIV. So if you identify someone who you think is newly infected, try and get them to help you with their network. You know, it's most of us are afraid to do that. That's like the patient will run away from us. They don't. And if you explain this, these are basic public health principles, contact tracing. We've done it for STIs for years, but something evolved in HIV to make us all think it was so different. Can't go there. You know, and that's not really going to work for all of us. And improved referral and engagement. Back in the day when we realized how many people didn't know, the other group that stood out was they once were tested, but they were no longer in care. The same numbers. Somehow we took 10 years to just focus on those who had never tested and didn't think about the one-third who had been tested but were not engaged in care, and we can go back and do that and do better. Mike Sag is probably right when he says most of those are no longer teenagers. All testing sites should know their referrals and know how to engage. So if you're testing, you got to know where you send someone for PrEP or for care. And engaging negatives. A big thing that I think we all skip in some ways is talking to positive kids about their sex partners. And we all know how high the rates of STIs are, even among positive people. Those infections are coming into the relationship either from that person or their partner. And so expanding our work with partners, I think, is very important for all of us. Now, I just want to say something, which is I give a talk with a lot of good information on it. Doesn't mean that we are doing everything and doing all this perfectly. We all have ways in which we could improve, and I always get surprised when we review our results. Oops, I thought we had that one. No, we got to go back and figure out what we're doing. So one of the other take-home lessons I want you to have is we're all in this together. We all need to continuously look at our practice and work on solving it. And there's no one who's really got all this figured out, especially when it comes to teenagers. Why are young people so susceptible to HIV and STDs? Well, there's three main factors: behavioral, biological, and socioeconomic. Adolescence is when you start having sex. Half of the kids have had sex by the 12th grade, and some of them it's when they're quite young. Homophobia and gender power imbalances make it difficult for those most vulnerable to HIV to be able to stand up, assert for condom use, or for other things. And the IPV talk, I think, was very instructive about differences with partner power. Mental illness, substance use, sexual abuse, all of those are things that make safer sex behavior much harder on an individual level. There are also really interesting biological vulnerabilities which make females more susceptible by males and account for some of the differences in the rest of the world. Just like, you know, a body changes from a child to a woman and their secondary sex characteristics, development of breasts, the cervix itself actually matures, and it goes from a single layer of columnar cells to multi-layer epithelial cells, and the single layer cells are thought to be more vulnerable to infections. We know it is for gonorrhea, but we don't know all the details yet about the vulnerabilities. In fact, this is really interesting. When it comes to women, we don't know what part of their anatomy is most vulnerable to HIV. Is it the cervix? Is it the vaginal walls? There's, you know, some pretty basic information that we could use more information on. Next is the rise of So STDs are often asymptomatic, more likely in women. So STDs, we know, enhance transmission of HIV. It's more efficient in general from males to females. But there's one group of men who have a lot of biological vulnerability, and that's men who have not been circumcised. So the internal cells of the foreskin or a mucous membrane more vulnerable to HIV than the head of a penis, and that was proved epidemiologically, translated into an intervention that's been shown to decrease HIV transmission, particularly in the African groups. Not all Africa is one place. Different groups, different religions have different circumcision practices. And socioeconomic vulnerability, the lack of healthcare coverage. Big part of the Affordable Care Act was to allow teens to access their parents' health insurance up to age 26. Very important and effective. Inadequate sex education, still a battlefield. What do we teach kids? And poverty, race, ethnicity, immigration, and housing differences all contribute to adolescent vulnerability. You've seen this slide before, high rates of youth STIs. We have the incidence of STIs among young people 15 to 24 reaching a record high in 2016. It's been rising. The trend is there. The numbers are there. This is a problem. And for those of us in the HIV prevention field, we do not believe PrEP caused this rise. But insofar as people think if they're on PrEP, they don't have to worry about anything else, then we're in trouble. I'm going to disappear for a second. So the question I asked before about do you like and feel comfortable with teenagers, this is number one as the characteristic of youth-friendly care. Providers who are non-judgmental, who are knowledgeable. Understanding confidentiality and consent, seeing adolescents separately from their parents at some point. And I would say one of my favorite interventions is cohorting. Pick a youth day in your clinic, Tuesday, Wednesday, where the youth will see themselves, they'll have the power of peers, you'll have on a staff that likes and respects teenagers. It's a very powerful intervention. If you don't have a lot of women in your clinic, you can do the same thing with women. Address the socioeconomic issues and empowering youth to reduce it to its most basic elements. Coping and mental health is a huge part of the work you have to do. HIV care itself and prevention. And we all know that prevention with positives is a huge challenge and a must-do part of our work. Treatment issues, adherence and viral load suppression is a challenge, even more so with perinatally infected youth. I don't know if you're not in pediatrics if you know this, but we used to put in feeding tubes for kids who wouldn't take their meds. You know, there's literally a power differential of getting kids their meds. Families used to be reported if their kids weren't taking the meds. So these are some legacy issues. But also in any case with adherence and adolescence, if you've lived with HIV all through your childhood, it's almost normative behaviorally to reject medications. So we have huge challenges, and viral load suppression, as you saw on the continuum, is much worse in teenagers. Ongoing risk of transmission, disclosure. You can't take a medicine if you have it in your house and the people you're living with don't know what it's for. Your medicine has got to be near a source of water, and there's no way you can take the medicine if people don't in your household don't know what it's for. Ongoing risk of transmission to others, thinking about reproductive health, and for us as providers, realizing that we can prevent transmission, but we really have to engage with young people on this and addressing their behavioral and psychological concerns and transition to adult care. So I'm going to be talking about a few of these. On viral suppression, immediate treatment is clearly a game changer, not saying, oh, wait until you get sicker, but we're going to treat you right away. Checking pubertal development. You could be 13 and not have started puberty. From medicine point of view, you got to take pediatric medications. Developmental issues are key. Teenagers can be very concrete and present-oriented. My adult provider colleagues say, and many of our adult patients can be that also, knowing how this person thinks and what works for them. I've started opening my sessions with, do you have any things on your list to talk about before I start asking you questions? And that's been a very helpful approach, and the same thing with medicines. It can be embarrassing, but knowing health literacy and knowing how people think is a very key part of what we do. Adverse events are intolerable. Oh, my God, side effects. And then, you know, what about the side effects of having HIV? You know, that's hard for people to make some of those connections. This is my personal favorite, the mistrust of providers, yet trusting all the misinformation they get from their peers. You know, I saw it on YouTube. Well, that's enough. I know my body, okay, but I know the medicine. You know, you want to interact in a friendly, but just because the kid says it doesn't make it the gospel. And perinatally infected kids do have unique needs, and we are not even halfway with sustained viral suppression. So I'm going to expose a thing to you guys, which is me and other adolescent providers, Michelle Ogle, who's in the room, Vincent Ramos, who I work with. We're a little skeptical about U equals U. It works if you're undetectable, but look, how many people really are undetectable? It's not universal. Yes, it's a truism, but then from a public health point of view, how applicable is it? The U.S. says 30% of people are virally suppressed. New York claims 74%. But youth are way less likely to have sustained viral load suppression. And so I think these big words, undetectable equals untransmittable, are confusing enough, but the concepts are also confusing to young people. And many people remain vulnerable to being detectable, personal structural instability, newly infected, and youth. What are some of the medical problems of perinatally infected youth? Well, we've long suffered from lack of pediatric formulations, PK, and complications related to HIV. Our dialysis service at one point had like 75% of their patients were perinatally infected. HIV is a multi-system disease, and the perinatally kids have it bad. Transitioning, this is a big issue, I think, for all of us, aging into and out of adolescent care. Remember, the pediatric model is supportive, the adult model is independent, and the parents are responsible for kids, and the patient is responsible for themselves. In adult clinics, we want to promote growth, self-expression, and work with adult clinics with multidisciplinary services and recognize the trauma of leaving care. Welcoming environments include, again, the idea of cohort. LGBT-friendly care is crucial when 80% of the new patients are LGBT. All LGBT kids have the same developmental tasks that all youth face, and most of them become healthy adults. And they have to develop a healthy, integrated identity amidst negative stereotypes and prejudice. If you stop right there, that's true for all vulnerable kids in our society. It's true for kids of color that they face prejudice. But generally, they have the parents who will have the talk with them. They have institutions in which racism, however poorly, but it can be addressed. Gay kids rarely have that inherent support, so they have to go look for it. You can't be gay, you'll shame the family, is a common thing you hear. And prevention is something that is really a crucial part of our work, but as the red dot shows, that's time for another talk. I don't think I have anything to worry about. I assume they're negative. If they're positive, they wouldn't put you at risk. You can tell a lot by adherence. This, unfortunately, is the prevention strategy of not only many youth, but also many providers. I know that my gaydar does not work to identify gay people. I don't know about the rest of you, if you're much better. But let's not make assumptions. And PrEP, I think, was covered. These are the final things. We need testing that's more routine, recognizing that treatment saves lives, but not all can be ideally adherent. PrEP prevents infections, and condoms are perceived as old school, yet they're the best that we have for STDs. And finally, the six take-home points. The first one is that there's a new generation every 5 years, and so we can't just use the same old, same old. We gotta update all the time. There's not a person on the planet who doesn't know what Coca-Cola is, yet they have new ad campaigns all the time. HIV is missing in action, and it's no longer feared. It's like, it's hard to give a message why to accept PrEP when HIV is, we tell them, is so treatable. Fears of disclosure, confidentiality, and consent, and once again, the recognition that vulnerable youth are vulnerable in many ways, including to HIV. Thank you.
Great. So a couple of questions. This whole concept of cohorting youth on a specific day, is there concerns about confidentiality since they might see people they know?
Everything we do has two sides to it. I could explain that more, but I just, yeah, everything we do increases risk and vulnerability, but the benefits of mutual support so far have outweighed that.
Is there any evidence that starting on HIV medication when you're prepubescent impacts on your fertility?
I don't think there's any evidence of that. And in fact, you know, most pediatric providers are talking about third generation HIV in families.
So for perinatally infected youth, are there any particular interventions or messaging to improve adherence?
I think sometimes we have to take a step back to move forward, and instead of perpetuating the battleground, sometimes we might have to say, you know what, let's take a break for 3 months and then start over, because this will be life-saving. In that period, you could show them how their viral load has gone up, maybe their T-cells have gone down. And then, you know, it's always turning back to the patient. Why do you think? What would help you? Are some of the interventions. I don't think we have any Debbie-style interventions for this age group. Jeff?
Hi. Jeff Birnbaum from SUNY Downstate. Like Donna, I also work with youth. I guess it's as much as question as it is commentary. There's pending legislation in New York State to do away with expressed consent, documented consent, be it verbal or signed. And being that we deal with youth who are distrustful of providers to begin with, and we're dealing with, in particular, young MSM from communities of color, I find it a little bit disconcerting to hear about promoting agency and expertise around obtaining consent, yet at the same time, we have providers who don't want to have a discussion about sex, risk. I mean, the real problem is that providers are not engaging people. And if we take away people's agency over giving consent, we're taking away the one sense of one piece of agency that they have over whether they're getting tested, in particular around youth. aren't we betraying the trust and agency that we're trying to build?
Thank you, Jeff. And you can see why in New York State we still have the same laws we had when the HIV test was first licensed in 1985. This is a great debate, but I feel like it should no longer be a debate in 2018 going into 2019. It's not agency if you have a problem that a test is helping to detect. There's no reason in my mind to stick your head in the sand about knowing an information. What you do about that information is the next step, is the next issue. But no one would argue that if a kid is fatigued and bruising a lot, should not get a blood test to look for health problems that might be affecting that, to look for ruling out, screening away leukemia. There is no other medical condition where we think it's about the person's agency as to whether or not they can learn about a diagnosis. And I would argue on the flip side of that, that Black and Latino kids, especially young gay men, are least likely to have access to the best care. And nobody would say this about who's white or who's middle class would say this about their brother. Oh, let them decide if they're going to get that test. We, as healthcare providers, we look for health risks and health problems, and then we try and help the person access that. So Jeff and I disagree on this. I don't know where the rest of the audience is, but I feel like if we are going to end the app, how quickly did we buy into the U equals U? We have New York State is endorsing this as a health, it's a great slogan. There are many more problems with U equals U than they are in someone inadvertently being tested and finding out they have HIV.
I just want to respond real quick that unless providers who are not HIV providers in general learn to talk to patients about sex, doing away with consent is just going to be a pointless thing.
Okay, that's your opinion, you're not alone in that opinion, and Jeff and I have mutual respect over a lot of years. However, there is no one who explains every STI test and gets that or even tells people that syphilis is on the panel that I've seen. And I don't think it's an excuse that providers don't want to talk to patients. I think it's an excuse that we're not willing to, deal with this already.
Thank you, Dr. Futterman, for everything you bring to the field. I wanted you just to hear a little bit of your experience with PrEP, with youth, younger adults, about adherence, uptake, and unique challenges in that population.
Okay. Thank you very much for that question, PrEP and youth. Well, the first thing is it wasn't until the middle of 2018 that youth were able, because the FDA licensed the use of PrEP in minors. So I think some of the barriers were majorly institutional. The second is many places are moving away from mandating parental consent, and that also is a help in the work that we do. Disclosure, permission, a lot of things like that. The third is I think we need to really think about seasons of risk, and especially for adolescents, they're not sexually active equally all the time, so we need to do that. And then the fourth is thinking about duration of PrEP use. We are really good in our program at getting people into the first 30 days. After that, it really falls off. And we, from our funders, did not have to track that, so we didn't. So I think we need to look at what's actually happening and then base our programs. The ATN study that licensed PrEP for the minors showed that adherence does drop off. And I think there's a lot of personal support that works, a lot of interrogating why you want PrEP and why you don't. Why is one of my favorite clinical questions, and it gets back to the person. Thank you.
Thank you.